Sure, Master Echo, for inviting me to address the assembly this evening. And good evening. Now, before we begin, I have to ask you a question, and that is, would you buy a used Dharma talk from this monk? Because that's what I am preparing to offer to you tonight. You see, I have this philosophy that if one gives a Dharma talk and it goes reasonably well, and one is before another group of people who have not heard it and for whom it might conceivably be relevant, I feel no shame in doing it again. And since I don't recognize any faces from the Exeter Meditation Group in Devonshire, and I have reason to believe it might be relevant, I'm going to be shameless and offer you a used Dharma talk. And hopefully it may be slightly relevant because some of the topics in it, I sort of rang a bit of a bell listening to Reverend Master Echo's talk to the community a few weeks ago, and also here on Sunday, and perhaps even on the previous Sunday. So we will see if some of this may be a complement to some of what you're doing. I hope so. So, homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. The topic I wanted to explore with you this evening could be posed as a question. What is the trouble with training? The problem with practice? And I'm going to propose that the trouble with training and the problem with practice is that we do it. Now, on one level, that is an exceedingly stupid thing to say. Of course we do it. Practice wouldn't do anyone much good if we didn't do it. But that's not the level on which I'm speaking tonight. At another level, there is something better than you or I doing our training. And that is perhaps that we allow us, you or I, to be something that training does. To allow ourselves to become a manifestation of training, of the way. Put another way, instead of us doing Zen, allowing Zen to do us. Now, in part, but only in part, this is related to a problem in words. As you know, words are not the thing itself. Sometimes they are not even a very good description of the thing itself. They have lots of unwanted excess baggage, but we have to use them, because otherwise we simply grunt. Which has its advantages sometimes. I say to my disciple, Reverend Hugh, that when we really want to communicate closely about a matter, we need to point and grunt. But we also use words. For instance, I looked in the dictionary on the words training and practice and the way. And let me share some of the common definitions. And you'll see some of the excess baggage which goes along with those words and that can't help but influence our minds a bit. Training, the action of undergoing or following a course of instruction or discipline in or for some particular art, profession, or practice. Practice, the action of exercising oneself in or pursuing an art, profession, etc. Secondarily, that which one carries on or carries out habitually or constantly. It's getting closer. Way, a path or course of life, not bad, an expedient method by which some end may be attained. Now, listening to those, you'll notice two problems right away, problems that sort of creep in frequently. One is that there is an implication that training or practice is a means to an end. And the second implication is that they are something which we take on, we adopt, and by implication, therefore, can set aside, sort of as if one puts on or takes off a suit of clothes. But if you take Dogen's proposition that training is enlightenment seriously, then it cannot be a means to an end or something that is put on and taken off like a suit of clothes. For if we do that as a means, it guarantees our separation from and therefore our frustration in finding the very ends that we are using it to try to be a means towards. Training and enlightenment are one, says Dogen. So how can one thing be a means to itself? It goes beyond means and ends. It's closer, I think, if we think of training or practice as an offering, not as something you do, but as something you give, something that you place upon the altar of the Buddhas and ancestors without restrictions, that you bow to and walk on without expectations, and something that comes, if you will, from the heart rather than from any attempt to seek, to find, to achieve. Better yet, I would say, is to think of training, or to not think of, to view training as a life, your life, something that you are rather than something that you do. And to think of, or to view that life itself as the offering that you place upon the altar. Now, if one is to view training and practice in that way, it may help a bit to consider for a moment why one does it. Why is one a Zen student in the first place? There are, of course, many reasons. If they are in the general area of doing it to look cool, be special, or have something that other people don't have, you are going to be very disappointed in this practice. The Soto Zen way of practice will never be trendy. It will never be flashy. It will never be a popular mass movement. It's too ordinary. It's also too much work. It's too unrelenting and too down to earth. In fact, it has been summarized rather well in a drawing done by the Zen monk Sengai, who lived in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And he summarized this form of Zen by the following picture, which I hope you can see. I'll pass it around. It's called the turnip. And the inscription on it reads, very roughly translated, Zen trainees are like turnips. They just sit. It's very cute.
That's right.
Wonderful. I have just said that your life of practice is to make you into a vegetable. And not any vegetable, but a turnip, nonetheless. Well, welcome to Farmer's Zen. Soto was called I think probably somewhat pejoratively in the beginning, farmer zen, rinzai being called samurai zen in old Japan. But Soto rather liked that, and so have kept the term. Yes, we are farmer zen. We are very ordinary, very down to earth, and very hard work. But if one is doing this out of a love for truth, or to give up all attachments, or to find the end of the chronic inner dis-ease that one senses, and if one would be satisfied with a tombstone that reads, "This one was a decent human being," then perhaps you're in the right tradition. Notice that those things I just mentioned are not anything that you can have. They're not anything you can get or attain. They are only things that you can give and be. They are a life of offering, which is not something that can be a means to anything else, nor put on or taken off. Now I'd like to look at some of the possible implications of viewing one's training in this way, as a life, as an offering. One implication is that a person cannot afford to place anything at all outside the scope of their Zen training. Nothing can be reserved, nothing can be held back, set aside, or kept as mine. That is separate from practice. The reason is obvious. If you take seriously that all is one, and if you wish, for instance, to be one with truth, you can't do that by holding bits of you back, because then you are not one. You are two or three or however many bits you hold back. And this, over the length of time, does not work very well. It is to adopt a position, if one holds back, is to adopt a position which a Christian monk, contemplative monk, expressed to Reverend Master Jiu once, which he found a delightful way of expressing this life of reservation. He said to her, "Sometimes when I pray, I get the uneasy sense that I'm saying, 'Lord, thy will be done, but not just yet, please.'" And that isn't good enough. It doesn't make it. And it also implies that training is for life. It is a lifelong thing, because it is life. And if you look at the historical lives of Shakyamuni, or Bodhidharma, or Daikan and Oh, or Dogen, or our own teacher, Reverend Master Jiu, or any of them. They didn't stop at some point and say, "That's enough." None of them. They kept on doing exactly the same ordinary thing of practice, of training. Getting up, putting on their robe, meditating, eating breakfast. Very ordinary, continuing onwards for their entire lives. A second implication of training as life and offering is that when we become self-conscious of ourselves in the act of training or practice, that is a thing which can and must be dropped away. Thoughts such as, "Now I'm doing my training," or "Am I doing my training now?" Or "Am I meditating?" or "Now I am meditating." Or, as I heard someone once say, "Don't bother me, I'm being mindful." Those are things one can drop. It's like the practice of meditation itself. As Reverend Master Jiu was fond of saying, you never know when you're doing it, only when you're not doing it. And of course, that's all you need to know. So that is, when you're not doing it, is the only time you need to be doing something different. You can apply that to the entirety of practice, not simply to meditation. Another aspect of self-consciousness that can be dropped off is self-consciousness or attachment to the forms of the practice. Now, of course, forms are useful. Indeed, they're necessary. There has to be a way, a vehicle, a medium for doing one's training. The forms provide that. And they have evolved over many, many centuries of wonderful practice by those who came before us. They are expressions of the way. And of course, initially, one is self-conscious about them while one is learning them. But I'm not speaking of that sort of self-consciousness. That fades naturally in time. What can be dropped is the self-consciousness that comes from being attached to the particular form itself as a thing. Just as words are, so forms of practice are fingers pointing to the moon. They are both the thing, because the thing itself, and not the thing itself. They are the thing itself because everything is the thing itself. And they are not the thing itself in the sense that the moon is not confused with the finger that points. So what I'm suggesting here is, yes, take forms seriously. In fact, take them so seriously that you allow yourself to sink into them and they into you. Merge with them. Become one with them. And thereby find their source and their spirit. But don't take them seriously in the way in which you grab hold of them and worry about them. Or you'll never find that place of oneness. And one will tend to kill the very spirit that the form is intended to bring forth. It also implies not worrying too much about getting one's practice right. Because practice is not a magical formula which will only work if you get it just right. Many of us, including this one, from time to time worry, am I meditating correctly? Heck, I sometimes worry, have I ever meditated correctly? Well, it's not something that you have to get exactly so, or it, quote, won't work. See the problem with won't work, as that's already into the means to an end kind of thing. Senkai had something rather fun to say about that as well, about getting one sitting exactly right. It's another drawing. It's called The Frog. It says, roughly, again, if sitting perfectly is what made you into a Buddha, dot, 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 implication, every frog in the paddy field would be Buddha. And of course they are on one level. And on another, that's not what we're speaking of. It's not magic. Trust that there is something bigger at work than you getting it right. Let it do its work. Don't try to direct your own Buddha nature. This is where, in one sense, one can allow Zen to do you, rather than you fretting about doing Zen. Another side of not being attached to the form and of practice and training is one can afford to be patient. Frequently, one, this one included, have thoughts come up that, well, if I was doing the practice right, something different would be happening. Well, that could be true. But I am beginning to suspect that more often than not, there's nothing wrong with the practice. You may just need to do it for, say, another 20 years, or much if anything happens. And what are we attached to having happen anyway? Whatever it is, it's not going to be what we think it is. So that is another thing which simply can be dropped away. And you can trust your own Buddha nature and the way that the Buddhas and ancestors have developed over time. And allow it to do its work on you rather than you work on it. This is also what Sangha is for. Consult if you have questions about your practice. You're not in this alone. And we can and do help each other in these ways. A third implication of this way of viewing training is to think of what it means in the large scale to live this sort of life. And it's actually fairly simple. Some meditation on a daily basis is advisable. And during the rest of the day, we bring the practice to bear on everything. We use the willingness to be mindful, to follow the Eightfold Path, behave in a way that is ethically acceptable by the precepts. When we see that which can be dropped away, drop it away. When we see that which can be accepted, accept it. Allow the bodhisattva ways of benevolence, charity, tenderness, and sympathy to arise. It's not very complicated. It's all very ordinary stuff. In fact, Dogen himself summarized it in just a few sentences. I'll quote, this is from his chapter of the Shobo Genzo Shoji, Life and Death. I'm going to use Rev. Master Jiyu's translation here. The last, it's a very long sentence. No, last two sentences. The first one's very short, the second one's very long. The short one is, the way to Buddhahood is easy. Yeah, I love that, don't you? That's the hook. Well baited. Okay, I'm ready. The easy way. Finally, we get to hear the easy way. Okay, right? Here it comes. They who do not perpetrate evil, they who do not try to grasp at life and death, but work for the good of all living things with utter compassion, giving respect to those older, and I sort of mentally put older in quotes here, it means more than just age, and loving understanding to those younger, again in quotes, than themselves. They who do not reject, search for, think on, or worry about anything, have the name of Buddha. You must look for nothing more. That's Farmer's End for you. And it's true. Another implication is that one can afford to not look too long across the fence at the greener grass that grows in other forms and other practices, all of which are wonderful. You don't have to long for hard koans, severe sessions, oriental forms, all-night meditations, special initiations or empowerments, the martial arts, tea ceremony, flower arrangement, or anything. There's nothing wrong with any of those. They're great. They're useful. They are an integral part of various lineages and traditions of Buddhism, for which I have great respect. They don't happen to be part of ours. And yes, the grass will sometimes look greener. But with each thing, there are positive and negative aspects. And looking over the fence at other practices has the negative aspect that it can foster a dichotomy between practice and life. These are things I can collect to add to my practice. value, I guess I'm saying, value the sheer ordinariness of the practice you have. Value its unremitting, unrelenting, gentle going on, because that is its strength. That's not its weakness. That's its strength. There is no need to apologize in your own mind for not doing hard training. You're right. This way is not the way of hard training. It's the way of soft training, of gentle, flexible, compassionate training, which just keeps on going and going and going and going. Another implication. If training is life, and there is nothing to be outside of it, does that mean I can never relax? Nope. It's just the opposite. I would say it means you must relax. Relax into the training. I'll tell you a little secret. It seems to me that true relaxation is only possible when you give up everything. When you stop trying to use your thoughts and emotions to direct your life. Set them aside and trust that something deeper knows what it's doing. Then you can truly relax. And you can have perspective and sometimes perhaps even a little humor about your own humanity. Sengai had another example of that. His answer to can you relax into training is the following picture. I'll quote the poem in a few minutes, not quite yet, so I'm not going to pass it around, but I'll just show it to you. It is entitled, Hote Arising from His Nap. Hote being one of the manifestations of Buddha. Arising from his nap. Yes. So, from this perspective, rest, relaxation, recreation are not outside training, unless you make them so. It is perhaps not a question, so much a question of whether you watch a football game, but how. Are you caught up in the winning and the losing, in the my team and theirs, in the how it should be played? Or can you simply enjoy the skill, the fitness, the courage, the choreography, if I might say so, of the plays? I'm reminded of the occasion when, many years ago, when Reverend Master Jiu got the local congregation together, some of you will remember, and suggested that there was a new way of training that she wished to introduce to the lay congregation. And that was that she would like to ask them to get their families together, those who wish to do so, and have a lay sangha camp out together. No monks around, just the lay congregation. And that she was going to give them, if I remember the story correctly, and I may have it not quite right, but I think we get the basic point, a special instruction. Ooh. As to what this practice, the core of this practice was. And they got them together and she said, right, the core of this practice is to have fun. That is your practice for the lay sangha camp out. Make that your training. They've been doing it, what's it been, 20 years?
14
14 years. They've been doing it now for 14 years. seems to grow. It's good training. And it's fun. The two are not incompatible. Because training is not a grim business. It is life. Now, sometimes one inquires, or at least the thought arises, what if I can't do it this completely? What if I can't make it my entire life? Well, what exactly does that mean? What if I can't do it? What can't one do? Are we saying to ourselves, I can't do the honest best that I can do? It doesn't make much sense, does it? But the honest best that one can do is all that's ever asked in this. And everyone, by definition, can do that. So if that's not the real question, what is? Well, sometimes when we ask ourselves, what if I can't do it? We're actually saying, what if there are some areas of my life that I don't want to bring into the scope of Buddhist training right now? Okay, that happens. Accept the fact that that's what you're doing, if you're doing that. Training by force doesn't work. Don't conclude that you're no good as a trainee. Just conclude that there's more to be done. And do the honest best you can in all those areas of your training that you do, all those areas of your life that you do allow training into. And those areas will affect everything. Because it's one life. It's not really compartmentalized. So every act of training influences every bit of you, even if it's indirect. And recognize that this state of partial commitment is an unstable state. It will not, it cannot remain there indefinitely. It is the nature of things not to do that. In time, a way will open that you can see to allow training into an area where you don't allow it in right now. And when that way does open, when that door does open, then you can and must walk through it, because it's right there. Above all, don't give up on yourself or training because you hold something back. Don't judge it. Trust that training is bigger than holding back. And it is. Holding back cannot withstand the force of gentle, continuous training. Sometimes, however, when we ask, what if I can't do it, we're actually asking, what if I don't meet my expectations? Well, the answer there should be fairly obvious. The problem isn't with the training, it's with the expectations. You remember the line in the scriptures, here born we clutch at things, and then later on compound delusion by following ideals, right? Don't plague yourself with the ideals. They are a thing which you can afford to drop. This is where I will quote the poem that's, again, roughly, that Sengai accompanied his Hotei arising from a nap. It says, Shakyamuni is long gone under the twin sala trees, which is where he died. Maitreya, the Buddha yet to come, is still in the Tushita heaven. I am getting old. This is no time to be chasing after ideals. Oh, dear. Yes, quite so. Now, all of this, as I said before, isn't actually about words. It's about what lies beneath them. Nor is it about forms. It's about what lies beneath them. I fully intend to continue to use words such as training and practice and way. I fully intend to continue to use the forms of our training and practice, for they are the vehicles for it, the manifestations of it. So it's not about substituting other words or other forms. It's about not getting caught. Not getting caught by words or forms or thoughts or ideals or anything. In other words, not imposing limits upon training. Not imposing limits upon offering. Not imposing limits upon Buddha nature. Trusting that something is very wise and will lead you on within a life of training. It's about holding nothing back. It's about taking every opportunity that opens before you and walking through each door and making each offering that you're aware of being able to make. It's about living the life of training and relaxing into it, trusting it, and even enjoying it.
Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds.
Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.